Hello and welcome to the Mystic Cast, where you join Jack Stafford and Deborah Littleboy, members of the Aetherius Society, the cosmic religion for the Aquarian Age. As we break down the barriers between religion, science, metaphysics, philosophy, and mysticism, all of which are really only aspects of the self-same quest for truth, please note this is an independent program, not produced or fact-checked by the Aetherius Society. Today, our guest is John Hogg. Hello, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you. Where are you in the world?
Behind me, this office is in the little village of Langley, Washington, on Whidbey Island, 40 miles northwest of Seattle.
That's a nice place to be.
One of the most beautiful little villages in the United States, a rarity given our architectural
junk. Yeah, right, anyway. In an island there. That's so close to nature. That must be...
Well, I have the Saratoga Strait right out my window here, and I can walk right down to the seals and stuff if I want to. And it's just, this is really, I've been here for 23 years. I used to live in Seattle, and I was born in Hollywood, California. So
so important for a man such as yourself to, you know, who's all about all about tuning in, you know, all about getting in the right frame of mind, the right frequency.
Well, in fact, it often happens that people are pulled here, many people are called by this place. There's a lot of ley lines right on First Street where I live.
Oh, yeah.
And I live six blocks farther south before, but now it's, the reason why I'm here in Langley was because of the third of three major premonitions in my life, which I wrote a book about called Nostradamus Premonitions of 911. And so when I went to India to the last time I was at the ashram of Osho, my master, I started having this premonition that built from March 2001 and kind of like I have to get out of the cities. My work is going to require more nature to nourish me, to be the fool on the hill surrounded by a moat of water, deal with a much bigger uptake of my work. And the premonition reached its peak on the 10th of September, 2001. And then finally, the following day, I'm having a strange dream where I'm hearing my Australian literary agent of the time calling me by my Sanskrit name, Arjuna. And he's going, Arjuna, Arjuna, he's calling from London. It's happening. It's happening. The towers are going down. The terrorists are attacking them, just like you've been writing all these years. And he'd say, and again, the third time I woke up and saw it wasn't a dream. And I pick up the phone and I say, well, what's happened? Everything you've been writing about for the last 20 years is coming. And the towers are under attack. And so I rushed out of my office, turned on the TV just in time to see the second jet come into view and then behind the North Tower and vomit a great flame, just as Nostradamus had predicted in his prophecies. So this process that I documented in the book is something that started in 1983, where the key was the Hollow Mountains being plunged into a boiling tub or a cauldron, and in the great new city at latitude 45. Now, if you understand maps in the 16th century, they had no longitude, so they could be off by several degrees. And so the thing that really helped was to understand that there was no great new city, that have its name mentioned, a great new city that in his time did not exist. I mean, the first... European people that went there was another century. And then this vast great new city. There's only one that could be called the new city. It's New York City. And so some people like the Penn and Teller, James Randi, and those folks used to make a career trying to ruin mine. And Ben Gillette made a challenge. He said, I challenge any of these people that saw this coming in Nostradamus or prophecies to, why didn't you warn the world? I'll give you just the day before. Why didn't you warn him? Because you didn't. You all should go to prison. You're terrible people. Well, he's even more ebullient than Donald Trump is. And he got kicked out of Donald Trump's Celebrity Apprentice show because of that. Anyway, so I took his challenge. I said, this is important. I washed off all the bombacity off of it. And I just said, no, this is I'm going to answer you. And so what I did is not only tell my story, which included being taped in 1994 for a Fox Network national broadcast to our show called Prophecies of the Millennium, which you can still see on YouTube sometimes. And basically my segment, we were asking, will the towers be hit again and will they go down? And I basically said, they will go down. And and what they did, I didn't know this, but later they did this whole special effect where they had a small nuclear device going off over the towers. And when the flash ended, the towers were down. Mm. And what is stranger about it is that millions of people saw it, and it wasn't broadcast again till 2 weeks before 911. And it was on FX channel. So I'm calling, I'm still watching the thing as it's happening. I'm actually seeing as a sleuth detective, it's kind of like a precog Philip K. Dick moment, because I'm anticipating an event that had not happened, and I'm trying to find the culprits and all of that since 1983. And as it gets closer and closer, things become more clear. But even then, some of the things that I could not figure out, like boiling cauldron, what is he meaning? And I'm watching it. When the towers, he said, they shall be plunged into a boiling cauldron. And, he's trying to explain the boil of the steamy stuff that he did in his own walk-in fireplace in his own cuvee. And so that was one bit.
Maybe just back up a little bit, just for anyone that's just, because you've dived right in there into the cauldron, which is great. We're up and running. But I just want to back up a little bit and introduce what we're going to be talking about today is prophecies. True channel or fake, how to tell the difference. And so you've built a career, your career. So is that the right word? You want to use the C word?
Yes. Profession, career, calling.
As prophecies.
Absurdum maximum.
Yeah. So do you work with your own prophecies or just with Nostradamus?
I contend that you can't, it's like if I told you, I'm an expert of love. And you know why? Because to be objective, I've never fallen in love. So I know what love is because I didn't get lost in it. Mm. Well, the problem is with anything that's mystical, it's a subjective science. It is not about the scientist making something. It's saying, who is Albert Einstein? What is the witnessing consciousness inside of him? So I think one cannot claim to be an expert in love or prophecy unless you have had direct experience and cultivated a talent for loving or for seeing the future.
Mm. You are a man of experience in that respect.
And also, I've learned from Edgar Cayce's prophecies to document and date tag everything. Mm. So I can know where I'm right or wrong. And because so many people are afraid of it because they've got a little ego involved with it. They just say, well, what if I'm not really, I must be making it always accurate. No, it's impossible because the future is always in motion. Mm-hmm. Even though that was said by a fictional character, Yoda, but it's true. It is always in motion. And what makes it predictable is unconscious, robotic, artificially intelligent habits of human beings. And, the very idea that science is looking at artificial intelligence and not one of these creators of it, I asked him, I said, how can you put artificial next to intelligence and have it nothing more than phony, fake projection? You're a mind amplifier. That's true. But there's no wisdom here. There's no intellect. Intellect is not intelligence.
Mm-hmm. So you're clairaudient or clairvoyant? Because our master, we have a lot of prophecies in the Aetherius Society as well. So we're trying to see the connection between our teachings and what you're talking about. And our master, he was one of his most famous prophecies. He was clairaudient. He heard a voice speak at the top of a mountain about the coming of the next master. How do you get your prophecies?
There's no you. I was initiated into this work by my master Osho in India in 1987.
You met him, yeah, when he was still alive.
Oh, I was initiated by him in 1980. My sannyas, neo sannyas name is Swami Dhyan Arjuna. And I have been a disciple of Osho since 1980. And yes, I was there. I was in the Oregon commune. I was in all of it. Very different.
Were you the one in the Netflix series as well?
I think you can see me in the clips of the celebration where the dancing and singing and the bands in the background.
And, how was that? That
looked like I'm one of the singers trip. In the band. So
that looked like, was it a fair documentary, you think? Or
well, to quote my friend Mutribo, who all that footage, he was our videographer, mm-hmm. and he was so enthused that they found all this stuff, because what basically happened, even in my little village here in Langley, is a lot of people asked me, it really moved a lot of energy, and I would even say, as Osho used to say, bad publicity is as good as good, maybe better. And I mean, one time when I was working in the press department, Hasia, who's also, he had a lot of those people I knew Sheila, I knew them all. And Hasia would come after, this is in India after the ranch, she'd come and gather all reporters together and say, well, you know, had this Independent India report that was terrible, you know, the usual, you know, slanders. And so she related, well, he listened to all that in his chair. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly asked, was there a picture of me in the article? Yes, Osho, there was. Was it a good picture of me? Yes, Osho, it was beautiful. He went, good. The power of Murti, the power of image. I mean, Osho, being a modern master, did that through media. We never heard Buddha's voice. We never heard the pregnant pauses. We never saw the knowing looks. All of the masters up to the 20th century now have been people that we just have the deadest thing left, words, without the living context. So basically, to get back to the thread of prophecy, well, just to say one thing,
is an interesting diversion, though. I must say.
It's a classic example of how the producers had no understanding of what they were trying to handle. So they looked for something they could understand, something egoic, and they got Mon on Sheila, and they turned it into the Sheila show. But I've had people constantly asking me, but it's almost like Osho and those people, and they're also alive. And it wasn't a play act. I lived there for 4 years. It's the way it is. And people who stayed with us, they said, you guys really aren't acting. You really are happy and blissful. Yeah, we are, you know? And so all those, that beautiful, bare, sparse, zen-like Oregon high desert with these little pinpoints of red, people were really, the energy, the presence, just like the Indian article, which was really slandering Osho. If there's the picture there, then the people who can resonate with such things will recognize it because it's merging in them already. So the Murti, the image of the master, is all that matters, not what you like or think or reason. I mean, it was an image of his picture on a book that attracted me, in a book called For Mad Men Only. The price, your mind. And I loved it because it opened up with the guy saying, you better put this book back and look one side and the other side and quietly walk away. And then there's a pause. It says, are you still reading? Oh, you're in for it now. I used to be like you. It was a great way to bring it in. That book was the start. And then, you know, as clairaudience goes, the moment that my life changed forever was when I was feeling this up and down, high, low, like going like this in one day. And then suddenly as I'm laying in bed, I felt a presence in the room and I got up, I sat up. And as I sat up, I heard very clearly in the center of my head, the voice of Osho saying, be aware. as loud as that. And then the mind was going, no, that didn't happen. That didn't happen. And then when the watcher of the mind let it in instant, I knew that my whole life would be with him for better and worse, that this was the path, and all of the seeking was over. And then I was there. Mm-hmm. And so he initiated me into this. And basically, to get back to your question about how the divination is done, you know, I have clairaudient experiences. I also have smells, other, but it is an experience. I am the guest house that's prepared with meditation to receive the wind, invisible itness that comes in when it wants. And I am completely out of control. Even when I do my psychic readings, I am simply just an empathic medium, and with no investment in it continuing or not, I'm just the guest house.
Do you think it's like the Akashic records, or are you a medium for other entities?
Well, it's interesting you ask about the Akashic records, because I had a Satori when I was 21 that was, I was very much involved in Robert Monroe's gateway program, the 60,000 people that were using his theta wave, 32 track tapes to what he was trying to do. And he was remarkable at this. He was trying to get people into a theta state, which is the state that often happens when people simply stop and are in. And he was artificially giving a milieu, kind of doing what meditation techniques are. They are creating the room, the guest room, for the mystery to come. And one cannot hold on to it if it goes. Just be. and so at that point, I was doing Zen breathing meditations, and I suddenly got very, very, very tired, like I was stoned. And I could hardly get up. I said, I'm so exhausted. And I collapsed in my bed with my shoes on and all. I just collapsed and went out. And at a certain point, as I was kind of hovering between waking and sleeping, I was looking down at my shoes and said, oh, I've gone to sleep with my shoes on. But then I thought, well, how am I able to see that? Because I'm laying down here. And then I go, and I went, oh, I'm out. And I'm out 100% aware. And so I suddenly hovered up to the corner of the bedroom at the ceiling, and I suddenly heard distant waterfalls that were made of voices all around me. And then at a certain point, I began to do something that's going to be very hard to explain in linear, non-vertical experience, horizontal experience, but yeah. I became a sphere of seeing. All the sphere was an eye, seeing all around it. And it was also inside going in. At the same time, it was going out. And what then happened is I started to expand out of the planet, whatever I touched, I became. And then at a certain point, I was in this vastness that was in all around me were infinite incidences. You know, it's funny. I think the Wachowski folk who made the Matrix, they must have had some, I mean, they make it very technical, all the TVs all around. Mm-hmm. It was like that, but not so neat and tidy.
I love that, the sphere of seeing.
And I went, oh, these people have had a little glimpse of something, like the Akash and the Narada had sent them to the Akashic records. And what was happening was, it would be what Nostradamus would call the God plane. He was basically a channeler of spirits in different higher heroes, archeons, demons. He also worked the grimoires of Solomon. He also knew them. And the all around me was everything that had happened, will happen, and is happening. I could go to one of the infinite portals and be there for 1 million years. and be there for 1 million years. But at the same time, the witness of it, it was just that much. At a certain point, the voices, waterfalls started to change. It started to sound like there was a problem. And I felt my attention felt find this in all that infinite spaces, that little portal of the man on the bed was me.
Mm.
And I came back to it, came through it, and I noticed my face was very pale and I was in trouble. So I was there and I made a mistake, and Robert would always tell us to do the opposite. But I want your consciousness or your attention consciousness can be like a flexing muscle, and it's squeezing and it's squeezing. Yes, there you go. Yes. And for our journeys, and the others are also really very good. So it's squeezing and squeezing. But the more I squoze, the more I could not get in. You can't make effort in this world of this. And then I realized, since I couldn't get in, I said, I think I've died. And so I simply relaxed. I mean, it's like suchness, such is the case. Tathagata, I'm dead. So I began to relax. And as I relaxed, my consciousness became a sank deeper and down and through the floor of the trailer park trailer. And as I came, and I was able to see things equally solid and transparent at the same time, which is very hard to explain, that things meet and there's no limit, no polarity. And as I was going under the bed, I could see the bed in the distance, the bed springs, the boards of the room. And as I was coming up, I was just being pulled by an attraction. My head, the nape of my neck and my hairy head looked like a vast planet. It was like, and the moment that I hit the nape of my head, I immediately felt myself in the dimensions of my cold, clammy body, as if somebody had taken my head like the edge of a towel and gone, whap!
Holy moly.
That violent. And I had a huge pain in my head, and I'm laying there. I can't feel my body. And I'm going, oh, my God, I've crashed, and I went in too hard. And so there was nothing to do. No, poor me. No, well, here we are. And so I just waited. And over the next 20 minutes, slowly, slowly, I began to feel more. And then when I got to the point where I could feel my hands, I went, oh, thank God, at least I have hands. So even if I'm in a wheelchair, I can write or something like that. And then very slowly, it got to my toes. And then I realized I'd come in too hard. So I did the old Robert Monroe thing where you go lay on your side, go back to sleep, and then you come out and readjust. But I have never been the same, never been completely in my body since that experience. I have kind of the eyes behind my head, but all over the place. So there were a number of things that happened in that point. And then when I came back from India in early 1981, I had another two very powerful experiences. Where I was given up for dead in an auto accident in Long Beach, California. And before it happened, I was in San Pedro going to see a girlfriend of mine that was down in the Utsava Sunyazan commune down in Laguna Beach. So she was preparing dinner for me. So I'm getting to the door and I'm feeling as if there's such a vast boot that's so big, the little ant can't even see it, and it's about to go watch on me. And I said, I don't know. I've got this huge, this is one of the premonitions. I feel like I'm going to die or something. And I hovered at the wind, at the doorway. I felt completely helpless to what to do, forward or back. And something pushed me out. And I got in the car. 45 minutes later, I'm driving in Long Beach, California. And a man in a big station wagon in my two-door Maverick, he rushed a red light at 55 miles an hour and hit me right in the side. And the moment it happened, the car, the world was like garment sheets being ripped apart, and I was thrown into an infinite goldenness.
John, this is fantastic stuff. It's gold, but I want to bring in Deborah here because the fans will get upset if they don't hear from her, and she's going to help us keep on track as well.
Okay.
Because
I was in the story.
Yeah.
I'm just noticing I'm getting a little bit dark and hazy here.
Should I put my dark and hazy. Maybe you're having an NDA.
Yeah, well, maybe. I'll just go and put the light on and pop back.
All right, please continue with this. I just had to check in with Deb.
Okay.
It won't be long.
So I'm in this infinite goldenness, and I am. Robert Monroe was one of the first people to teach me to a kind of non-dualistic way of hinting with words, though they are creatures of the horizontal timeline trap. But I could convey that I was not there, not thereing, with two others who were absolutely not there, not thereing. And they never spoke to me. That's why I could hear the message without them talking.
You'll explain this to me afterwards.
Well, I'll do my best. I'll put Deborah's in the gaps so I can't quite follow, and it would be a good story still.
So let's just mention some of the. Let's get back to prophecies, and let's because Deborah was talking about some of the prophecies from the Aetherius Society. Did you get a chance to check those out?
Yeah.
John.
I don't think we should leave the story just like that. It's
all right. Go on, finish the story.
It is you're going to have a lot of pissed off people, I think, if you do.
All right. Okay. I
predict. So they were not bearing, and they gave me a message which was never sent and received perfectly. And I put it in words, even though it wasn't in words. They said, you are back where you've always been. This is your home, and if you wish to stay, you can, because you've never left. But we are here to remind you that you had chosen to go back. And if you do go back, it will be very beautiful, not just for myself, but for many things. Now, I had kind of a data dump of like the next 100 years. So this comes up in my work. It was like all of it was just suddenly dumped. And so I made a message to them that they never heard, where I said, I'm really going to kick myself for going back to Long Beach, California. So I did. I got back. I was hunched over. I saw them all of my master and on my belly. I said, well, at least that's not broken. The car was an utter wreck. They were working on the other guy who had a broken arm. And then suddenly I got out of this. Well, I suddenly hearing a tap, 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 tap. And I'm feeling like a time traveler. I've got this cool radiant energy all around inside me. And I felt like I've come back from a journey from a million years away. And there's this pale paramedic tapping on the door saying, can you get out? And I was very calm. I went, yeah. There's a doorknob still on this side. So I push the doorknob. I step out. I'm all in maroon robes with my mala in a Long Beach intersection filled with gasoline. And there's a man. There's this man with a bozo hair with it kind of out like cowlicks and no hair on top, no front teeth. And he's running and his suspenders are trying desperately to keep his belly in their place. As he's splashing through the gas, he picks me up and says, oh man, you're alive. It's a miracle. He's from Ohio. He's the guy that called the paramedics in. The paramedics are in shock. And people were saying he's dead. He's dead. They didn't understand. It was very limber. I mean, I'm still very limber. And they thought that my neck had been snapped in the collision, and I was all white. So suddenly when I got up, it was like Lazarus coming back from the dead. And so anyway, he's grabbing my beads. He's saying, them sure good beads. I said, yes, they are. And then I finally said, look, I have some missing time. I have a concussion. Yes, go here and we'll take care of it. And so that was the really big severance. And I wrote to Osho about it. And he said, these experiences have almost completely cut your thread to the past. Now star, center, and call it Vikas, growth.
So, John, what would you say, or what did Osho tell you? What was your mission? Why are you here to prophesize? What's your connection with Nostradamus? Were you he? Do you know?
That would be telling.
Well, I don't. Yeah, are we uncovering something that you already had to bring here? I'm thinking maybe.
Well, let's look at the objective possibilities of that. I certainly look a hell of a lot like him. I mean, it's uncanny. I mean, when you, and there's websites all over the world debating this. The reincarnation has been a big lesson teacher for me, and if I say yes, that's not correct. If I say no, that's also not correct.
Yeah, two poles, same truth.
Because it's something vaster than that. There's an incredible, I will say this, just as a hypothesis. Wouldn't it be an interesting story if the great Nostradamus delivered these prophecies, not really knowing exactly, trying his best to describe them? And what if 4.6 centuries later, he somehow ends up in the times trying to interpret what he couldn't understand?
Yeah.
The only thing that's constantly true, all this things about people we were, people we will be, and a moment where all that goes, is the only thing that matters is that the human being rediscover their lost innocence of the eternal witness, the very source.
What you're here to teach us. Is that the mission? Do you think that's the main mission that you're here? Is that why you're here having these conversations?
There's no main mission any more than this mystery that radiates in all things that move and rise and fall are just appearances of the source that witnesses them, which is ever new and ever now. It can only be engaged by one relaxing into the eternity of the present. And then if you have certain things that you've learned in body, mind, horizontal life, going not just from here to there, but literally it's a horizontal picture of a wheel of samsara. You're going here, there, here, there, here. Chasing your own tail, trying to find the, thinking it's the Buddha's tail, and you're chasing it for millions of lives until there comes a moment, something that Osho said all the time. I mean, it was like, we'd be asked by the audience, what do you see when you see all of us assembled before you? And he'd grin and he'd say, I think you're great. And everybody'd laugh. He'd say, I think you're all Buddhas. And everybody went, what, you know, me? And he goes, pretending not to be. So if one takes it a subjective hypothesis, a subjective scientific hypothesis, since we're talking about the subject, us, who are in this world of things, I just finally, after decades, embrace the possibility that I've never found the Buddha because I am the Buddha. And all this searching is, for all good reasons and spiritual virtues, is always away from the Buddha. So then it becomes an issue of looking at the pretenses. How did I become a Buddha pretending not to be? And that is the question for all of us. Then the process, it kind of sets, I would say from my own experience, one on the right inward understanding that you cannot become what you already are. Every time we're born, we are the Buddha coming into the world, and then the world turns us into an ego. Now, there's a lot of things over many lives, some famous, some not famous, mostly not, that we cultivate in our mental body. The experience is that is probably the reason why each person who is a teacher has their certain way of teaching. Because, as I mean, Osho used to say, a lot of people get enlightened, but very few become masters. And because it takes a certain, in general, the life memory path, which will be the tools in this incarnation, finally recognizing it's the appearance of something that's eternal, will then use. And he says most people who have become masters have been teachers or artists. The difference between the Satchitananda of the arhat, who doesn't teach, he's just present there. He's got the right reason. Everybody's already this. It's good. With some time, they're going to discover that there's no time, and there will be it. So why should I upset people? And then there's the bodhisattvas, like myself, that are more satyam, shivam, sundaram. You know, we're not the people who say, "Oh, it's all illusion, so forget about it." You know, and Ramesh Balaskar was like that. I mean, very brilliant, absolutely. But that is not a thing that is going to, the love of aesthetics. Why say this is an illusion? It is not an illusion. The understanding of it is the illusion. That's the Maya. It's this world of appearances is in itself a real appearance. You know, it is, it would be like the ocean saying, "Oh, when I turn into shapes on my surface, that's not real, it's not happening." Well, of course it's happening. But what the Maya is, that the water contained in the shape of the wave identity sometimes forgets it's the ocean. So, I mean, Osho kind of opened my eyes about that. It's like, no, this world is real as it is a time of transcend appearances. It changes. Nothing lasts here, and yet it keeps growing again. Worlds rise and fall. It's the lila. It's the play of existence to be this creative force of appearances. But what then happens is that we get identified because the other waves, our parent waves, our priest and politician and pedagogic waves, are all saying, "You're a wave." And you then are separate from the other waves, and therefore you're competing, trying to get love, and we're all trying to find that other shore. But if we ever get close to it, we always fall back in the ocean. We don't understand. And we hit those breakers, hit the sand, and then they always come back. When we're supposed to dissolve into that. That's our goal if we look at it as a horizontal goal. Or that's where we're spinning the wheel of samsara. We'll eventually get somewhere. No, what happens is we eventually see the whole point. And the old soul gets a little weary and a little wiser in its memories. And then it changes where you simply, there's nothing. You cannot make this happen when you already are it. So the wave cannot make the ocean exist. The wave can just forget that inside its shape, which it puts all of its attention to look in, and you'll find everybody is the same ocean. All the waves can be vastly different, but everything and everyone is the same oceanic center. I guess I use this metaphor a lot because I'm a double Scorpio 12th house.
That's beautifully explained, though. Yes, it's the same truth said differently. I've heard the same thing said many times, but that was very eloquently.
Thank you. So to define myself in what I do with prophecy, it has a very tantric quality. That is, everybody fixates on sex about tantra, but tantra is about taking anything, even an interest in the future, and not suppressing it, but going full into it, whole hog, as Gurdjieff would say, head to toe, everything. And with awareness, you discover that if you go deeply into the future, into the possibilities of tomorrow, you always come back to the eternity of the presence. And that, so I tell people openly on my shows, as I'm going to tell it to your show now, I am fundamentally anti-prophetic. as anti-prophetic as my master Osho was anti-sex. He's called the sex guru because he actually created a situation where people can use their life force and love it and be in a protected way to use it. But he always said, don't just stay at the threshold. He wrote a book in India, which revolutionized India in the late 60s, From Sex to Superconsciousness. People couldn't even say sex in the early 70s or 60s. And it was such a shock that 50,000 people gathered in Mumbai to listen to this discourse series. And he basically, it's about using the orgasmic potential of the artist, of bringing life. I mean, for me, the big thing that opened me up was I heard Georg Solti's recording of Der Ring des Nibelungen by Wagner, The Ring of the Nibelung. And it absolutely opened me up to the ecstatic, which needs no cause. First, there's a trigger, but then you start to understand it's really about what Osho used to call it, choiceless awareness. If there's a choice, you're in some identity. But it also is an effect without a cause. If I'm loved, then I will be happy. If I find the soulmate of my dreams, then everything will be good. What about just having no reason at all simply to be blissful? Why not simply live bliss without a person, about this? Or it's like that great New Age song, let it go. It only comes back again if it's real. Let it go, because then it comes back because it's real. And so you there with it. In fact, you are the real. And everything else comes and goes. Lovers, wives, husbands, civilizations, universes. And still, you and you and me all come, whether we're aware of it or not, from the exact same ocean. Endless, bottomless ocean.
Which is what we're taught to, and that's no mistake, is it? Because that's exactly it, one source manifesting in multitudinous ways. Yep. To experience those multitudinous ways, colors, shapes, forms, sizes. Yeah.
The great joke, the great play, the great tragedy, the great triumph, the great all of it.
Yeah.
And of course, that also brings the times that we are in. There's a critical mass of things going on in the world that I became aware of this more in the late 1980s from some of my contacts in Native Peoples of the World, which had variations on the theme of this same idea. And that when we cleared 5 billion people, in 1988, around that time, that was a time that what Robert Monroe would call the M band, you know, you always had to pass through. It was like 50,000 radios blaring at once. And that, just like the ecosphere protects and balances itself out in the physical world, there is an etherosphere that also absorbs a lot of the unconscious, the collective unconscious things that people are doing. And we see, I figure that since the 5 billionth person was born, that was the moment when the etherosphere could not contain the insanity and unconscious thoughts and motivations, and it started polluting our world on a psychic level. And so as we've now another 3 billion people to that, ever since then, things that we would never imagine, even in our sleepwalking, we would never imagine that such things could be said. For instance, if you were a defense secretary in Reagan's administration, and if you had talked about talking yourself into fighting nuclear war with Russia, Soviet Union, you would have been taken off in a straitjacket. But now we have Jens Stoltenberg often musing on using tactical nukes in this current fight. And this is the other thing that I do with the Hoag Prophecy Report. I read the world and use all, and I'm looking at everything that's going on in the world that I can, and then I use the prophetic, or where is this going and what's the nature of it and what could cause it to not end the way these people are doing, because we are in the most dangerous period in human history right now, because one side, the Western side, as Nostradamus used to say, those planning this great war in the West, and it would happen around a great pandemic, which he also saw, this blood plague of COVID-19, which, you know, with all its clots and all of that, he said it'd be a plague of blood. It wasn't thought that first. It was thought it was just the sacs and the lungs. But then as I was writing this book on his prophecies on plagues, with this being the climax of it, suddenly in the middle of writing the book, they were starting to say, hey, this is a blood plague. I mean, its main vector of killing bodies is blood. So, oh my God, this is the blood plague that he always kept talking about. And he often talked about man-made plagues a lot of times in the prophecies. So I had to put that book aside in 1990. I wrote most of it in 1990, but the things I was capturing through intuition, I had to wait 3 years to resume it because I knew the witch hunts would be happening, the medieval panic that always happens in plagues. Well, we haven't grown that much. It still happens now. And so when people had alternative views and actually had data, no, you can't say that. People shut down and shadow banned. So I figured, this book, if I have any understanding of the present times, if I publish it now, it will not get to anyone. I have to wait until this madness of witch burning passed. So now I'm resuming finishing it with, now armed with all the data that had been suppressed, like the 800 tests that across the world documenting that masks do diddly squat. To help you, because just as Dr. Fauci said, and he dumped it early on, he said masks don't work because these are such small viruses that they touch your eye and get in through your eyes. So, you know, so now.
All right, John. Well, I would love to keep chatting, but unfortunately, we're end of time here. So, But so how can people keep hold of you, your website, and how they can?
The main thing is to go to hogeprophecy.com. That's hogeprophecy.com. That's where I usually show free samples of my Hogue Prophecy Report, which is a biweekly that I send actually to protect people and myself from the high tech tyranny. I send it as a PDF file to your email. And it takes a little time to send them all, but it is a way to, you know, one of the ways people are going to have to survive this deepening tyranny of tech and how it's being used to suppress freedom and suppress people is they're going to have to go back to a little low tech to make it work. That's what the Samizdat people did in Soviet Union. And now people in the so-called free world are having to do the same. So that's what I do with this. So you can do that. And also I not only read the world, but I also do on Zoom, private readings where use a little astrology. And then I use the Osho Zen tarot deck to go deeper and deeper into the layers. And they're mostly really joyful, wonderful experiences, and people really have a great time. So you'll see, if you go to hogeprophecy.com, you'll see at the, near the top, you will see Hogue readings in red, and then you just click on that email, put Hogue reading, and with the thousands of emails I get, I will find it, and then I get back to you describing what, how to be paid, and how it's done, and the times that are available. And so those are the three main ways to get in touch with me and also support this work, because
your new book will be coming out
Nostradamus Coronavirus and the Pandemic Prophecies is probably going to come out in October. I am working on an update of Nostradamus and the Antichrist, codename Mabus. That is another detective work I did from 83 on, where I'm looking at all the possible candidates of the third Antichrist. And I thought a few years ago that it was all done and we missed that bullet, until suddenly, dramatically, a figure came on the world stage that did what all my other candidates, other than the first Antichrist, Napoleon, the second Hitler, had done, become a significant world leader. What did you say?
Do we guess, or is it, who is it?
Well, I'll tell you this. When I, the new cover, which has a person, it's called My Christ. It's a beautiful turn of the century man staring at you. And first it looks kind of scary, but if you just stay with it, all kinds of things comes out of this man's face, who's dying of tuberculosis around 1903. He's an artist. And so I tell people, keep looking at it. At first it's scary, and then it's My Christ, it's himself. And there is all of that. And this story has this issue, because the person that, you know, Hitler was clearly altogether bad, but Napoleon, Nostradamus going after Napoleon is a little bit of a mixed bag, because Napoleon created a lot of good. The code Napoleon is because of Napoleon, either vicariously or not, that has spread the French revolutionary ideas all over the world and triggered 100 years of what revolutions. So this third Antichrist I'm finding is somebody more like Napoleon, has good sides to him as well as some nasty sides as well. And if you look at the word mobist, and the cover has a little change in this, it's the same cover I had before. It says Nostradamus and the third Antichrist, code name Mabus. You'll notice that I shade the vowels in MABUS grayer than the consonants. So what do you get when the vowels?
Let's put...
somebody let's called people... MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, crown prince and future king of Saudi Arabia, has literally, through his decisions to pull Saudi oil off the U.S. dollar, is changing the world. And that, I would say, is like a code Napoleon moment. It could be for the better. But there's other sides too.
Well, thanks so much, John. This has been really inspiring. You've given us a lot to think about, the great ocean of that is us all. And it's been... Have you enjoyed it, Deborah?
I have indeed. Thank you, John. I'm so pleased we got your camera to work.
Yes. It was working all along. I wasn't working.
There's another great metaphor in that.
Okay.
All right, John.
Okay.
Take care.
John, thank
Goodbye,
you.
Mate. Keep the strength. Bye-bye.